From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, Oscar-nominated writer-director Whit Stillman, is the inventor of what I like to call the Oxford Shirt School of Chatty Comedy, with his trilogy featuring, of course, Metropolitan, Barcelona, and the movie for which he was last here, The Last Days of Disco. His new film is Damsels in Distress. He's not in distress. He's sitting across from me. Whit, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It's so much fun to think about this movie's being, your other movies have been so much about educated people talking about their lives. This is a movie about people in college who seem to be undereducated and still talk all the time. I mean, this is kind of this willful, if they were an 80s band, they would be called the Blissfully Ignorant.
Yes, they're very ignorant.
Tell me about these characters and where that all came from.
I think you sort of write about what you love, and in the other movies, as being influenced by books and writers. I'd read in this movie, it's a lot of the movies that I love. So I really like dumb comedy. I love sort of Will Ferrell, dumb frat humor. And we have quite a bit of that in this film.
Just almost like a Will Ferrell version of Where the Boys Are.
I hope so, yeah, that would be great.
I mean, it feels like that way. And then that these sort of young women trying to take the world by storm and their idea of what the world is and what the world really is are two incredibly different things.
Yes, it comes together at the end.
Tell me about that, just because 1998 is when you were last here.
It's pretty bad, yeah.
I don't know, is pretty that bad? You tell me.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I'm kind of a failure as a producer. Unfortunately, I'm a hyphenate. And the writer-director part of it, I get, that works together. But when you add the producer to the equation, you get a certain amount of, in my case, incompetence. And so
which
I had
manifests
all kinds
itself in what ways?
Not getting my films going. So I wasn't that depressed being over in Europe, getting to work on various scripts. Because I felt I was being productive in my daily life. But I didn't get the projects off the ground, so I wrote the scripts and didn't see how to put them together. I think now I have a better idea how to put those scripts together, having been back in action and seeing sort of how low and efficient you can be in filmmaking these days.
Is part of it just as you were working the world of low-budget film, which you tend to work, was incredibly in flux?
Yeah. I think one of the problems was we talk about the housing bubble and bust, but there was also an indie film bubble and bust. And I think when Disco came out, we were right in the bubble. And the air was later coming out of it. And I didn't quite realize that it was not just me having trouble, but everyone was having trouble. And the air was coming out of the balloon, and then it really collapsed. And now I think we're kind of back to an 80s situation where we have to do things with extremely low budgets, extremely economically. And that's actually liberating. That's good. There are several filmmakers who have memorable quotes about the less expensive the film, the better.
Do you believe that too?
I sort of do. I mean, occasionally there'll be a Gone with the Wind kind of project which needs a budget. But if you're doing things that are a little bit personal, low money is pretty good.
Also, I mean, there tends to be a real kind of efficiency of time and compact storytelling in your work as well.
Yeah, we got really lucky with this film. I've been unlucky for so many years. I don't feel badly having been lucky with how this came together.
One of the reasons I'm guessing you wrote this is just something you knew you could get it made quickly.
Well, yes. I started coming back to the States more. There's another project that lured me back because it was going to be done here. And so I wanted to have a project in reserve. So I spoke to three companies about Damsels in Distress. It was under a different title then. The first people I talked to were Martin Schaefer and Liz Glotzer at Castle Rock, who had backed Barcelona and Last Days of Disco. And they liked the idea. And then two other companies, the only two I talked to about it, also liked the idea. But I went with Castle Rock because I spoke to them first and I had such a good experience with them and the other films. But then we ended up not making it as the Castle Rock film. It was made independently with investors they could put me in touch with. and at a much lower level. I kept getting this question when I'd go in for meetings about my other scripts, like, how much will this cost? And I would just throw these numbers up because I really had no idea. And you say things like, oh, $5 million, $3 million, or whatever. But you don't really know. No one's done a budget. And I see now that, you know, to do this kind of filmmaking, you've got to get really low. And oddly enough, if you go really low, then you have more time and more creative freedom. Those rather expensive indie budgets don't buy you many days because everything, every day becomes very expensive.
I'm talking to a man who's been away for this show for too long, Whit Stillman. His new film is by the director, is Damsels in Distress. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. Is this a film, you would tell me years ago you wanted to do a musical. Was this it, that in some form or another?
Gosh, I don't know. I just think I just generically wanted to do a musical. I don't think I had anything particular in mind because I doubt if I would have been talking about this in any form.
There's a lot of music in this, and it's also music as social function.
Yes, music is really important. And actually, I brought along the CD of the soundtrack.
I
want to give you. Milan Records is bringing it out, and I'm really excited about it. I think it'll be available both as a download and as a hard copy, quite pretty CD. And we're really excited about the music, and we hope that the Sambola will become the Sambola international dance craze.
Since you brought up the Sambola, I should ask you to explain for the audience what the Sambola is and what the movie's about.
Well, the movie follows a group of girls who want to revolutionize the social life in their very grungy, depressing, moronic university. And it's based on real stories I heard about girls like this at various universities.
It seems like a sort of a step cousin of a Seventh Sister kind of school.
Yes, it's sort of low-end Seventh Sister. It's sort of 14th Sister. But in this case, it's more like a sub-Dartmouth, because the idea is that it's been a very male school, very boorish, frat-dominated, and these girls have come in, but they've never really dominated their environment. And so this band of girls want to do that. And the spark plug of the story is a character named Violet Wister, played by the indie starlet Greta Gerwig, an actress I adore. And Violet's highest aspiration in life is to start a dance craze. And so she works towards that in the course of the movie. And it looks like she's going to be a failure in her aspirations, but it turns out finally not.
It's kind of funny, too, in that it's because I remember having a conversation with you once, one of the last times I saw you, talking about Last Days of Disco, and we talked about the ways that music really kind of pushed people apart.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that's kind of an answer to that, or should I say a balance of that, which music is a way to draw people together.
Yeah. I think music is really important in life and also in film. It's one of the things we can have that is very cinematic. So our films are kind of pilloried for being static, talky, stuck in rooms. But when those rooms fill with music and people dance, it does become more legitimately cinematic.
But there's music that's often been a part of the films, though. And when people talk about people sitting on top, and there's an awareness of music in those films, too.
Yeah, I like to consider them stealth musicals where they don't really break out in song and dance the way the great Fred Astaire movies did, but that there's a lot of music and dancing even in metropolitan Barcelona, etc.
Yeah, because music becomes a way to sort of deal with the social commentary in the films, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yes. I mean, music and dance is what brings men and women together in the most interesting way.
My guest, I guess we could say, is the new Gower champion, is Whit Stillman. His newest film as writer-director is Damsels in Distress. This is The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. But tell me about choosing the music for this film, because there's a piece that almost reminds me of an Al Green instrumental in it near the end of the film. That's really something just before the Sambola music number takes place. Tell me about finding all the songs.
That's a wonderful piece that Mark Suazo wrote. Mark Suazo is the composer who's worked on all of my films. In this case, Adam Schlesinger, another brilliant composer, contributed a number of great songs. Mark had this key piece that helped us a lot in editing, and he'd actually been working on it since right after we had done Last Days of Disco. We were immersed in Gamble and Huff Philly soul music, which we really loved. And in sort of inspired by that, he went and wrote this piece. And it it is on the CD as Violet's theme, and it plays a lot when Violet is sad. And it's very helpful to us because our comedies can be considered by some people brittle comedies. And with these moments of thoughtfulness and music, I think we can try to attain more emotional depth.
Because I know that when I talk, we end up talking about music quite a bit anyway, which makes me think of the films as being, in a way, certainly films in which music is always key to the way the characters think and
yes.
communicate with each other.
That's true.
And so it just seemed like a logical thing that you would make a musical.
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure about going into the formulas of musicals that have been already used and used so well. But I would love to explore ways in which, within our means, we could approach the musical. You mentioned Gower Champion. In this case, our Gower Champion is a young choreographer named Justin Cherney. And he had never worked in audiovisual media before. He'd only done theater pieces. And he was wonderful, adaptable to our kind of limited time and budget constraints. And some of the numbers came together so well. I can't quite believe how it happened because I know, you know, the conditions we're shooting in. But there's a number towards the end of the film where Greta Gerwig and Adam Brody are channeling Astaire and Rogers.
And basically, the whole cast ends up being a part of that.
Yes, the whole cast. And Doug Emmett, the cinematographer, just did a beautiful job with the photography there. And we had a big Gibraltar crane helping us out and this marvelous location near New York City.
After having been away for so long, wasn't it kind of terrifying to have a movie with this much production demands a little daunting?
Well, every shoot is really daunting and terrifying. And I think initially one reason I didn't get a film going quickly was because I was a little apprehensive about getting back in the trenches. Because I think, I'm not sure which analogy is best for it. In our kind of film, which there are not a lot of people doing the job, so it tends to be a lot of pressure on very few people and a lot of time. I think there is something called the quality triangle. So you can have two out of three, fast, cheap, and good. And so we have to have it cheap, and we aspire to have it good, so we can't have it fast. So you end up doing things over a long period of time, and you sort of feel that a project can go off the rails at any point. We showed the film in Venice and Toronto festivals, and the reaction was pretty great. But I felt that we'd closed the film up and hadn't really finished our music and sound jobs. And I think in this kind of somewhat fragile tonally comedy, if the music and sound are grating and irritating, it can really set people off, put their teeth on edge, so they don't enjoy the film as fully as we hope they will. And the strange thing I found was that when we showed the film in very funky, not very good conditions, it played really well. But if we showed it in a state-of-the-art theater with stadium seating and super-duper sound, it sort of exposed all the irritating aspects of the sound mix, at least in my mind.
We'll take a break. We're doing this show in super-duper sound. My guest is Whit Stillman. He's the writer-director of the new film, Damsels in Distress. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. If you like this program, check out other podcasts from KCRW, including Bookworm, The Business, DNA, Unfictional, and Good Food. They're on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back to The Treatment. It's on KCRW.com if you want to hear it that way, because you want to hear my guest, writer-director Whit Stillman, who has come back to this show after 14-year absence. His new film is Damsels in Distress. I guess the last time we were here, we were talking about Fernando Trueba. Basically, you got your start like helping to sell films in Spain, and it was fascinating to me that you you were telling me you were in one of his films?
Generally, I was cast as the stupid American in Spanish films. And that was the only one the part was substantial. And I actually had a love scene with the leading actress, the lovely Sylvia Munt.
How did you end up connecting with him, though? You were talking about that a little bit last time, but remind me.
I was going off to get married in Spain, and my future wife had friends in Madrid, and they gave us a dinner party. And there I met some producers, and I'd been trying to get into the film business. I'd been flailing around in low-end journalism. And I'd memorized the Variety special issue on the Spanish film industry on the flight over. I'd read it 3 times, and I impressed them as someone very knowledgeable about the film world, which wasn't really true. And I suggested that I sell their films to the Galavision Pay Service in the U.S., and they said, yes, go ahead and do it. And then I realized that you really sell films worldwide if you're going to make a go of it. So I got their films to sell worldwide, and through these producers, I met the directors, Fernando Colomo and Fernando Treba, and they're the two directors who put me in their films. And so I got to learn a bit about the business and a tiny bit about shooting. It sort of demystified shooting for me because I saw, you know, it wasn't rocket science, just people on set doing this and that. And I also saw that sometimes a film with no planning and no resources, such as Fernando Colomo's Skyline, could turn out really well, while Fernando Trevo, who had a lot of resources for his film Sal Gorda or Bad Taste, had a really, really tough struggle with his film. And so it's not about, you know, the budget. It's not about the planning. It's not about the amount of work you do. There's a kind of mysterious karma of a project that comes alive and should exist and is beautiful in its existence.
And it must also help, too, in some cases, to not have a kind of a institutional hampering over you, because that can sometimes add to the gravitational weight of the movie, can it not?
That's definitely true, but I don't think in this case the problems were that. I think they were within, you know, dream collaborations on the first project becoming nightmare collaborations in the second project, that kind of thing, between the creative talent.
Oh, sure, sure. But it seems to me about your work that there's been a kind of a karmic feel to them, you know, and because they are films about karma.
Yeah.
And I just wonder where that kind of offhanded and touching on spirituality comes from.
Well, it's something that came into the films not entirely consciously, but when it did, we welcomed it.
You didn't set out to do it.
Well, it's hard to know what you're setting out to do. There are certain hymns and certain sort of aspects of religion that are very beautiful and very moving and profound. And I thought that I wanted to bring them into the movies, but it wasn't a sort of conscious plan. And so with the triptych of the first 3 films, curiously, they begin with The Mighty Fortress Is Our God on the soundtrack, the title credits of Metropolitan, and it ends with Kate Beckinsale singing Amazing Grace at the end of Last Days of Disco, because she just belted out heroically on set. But then we wanted to turn it into a song for the tail credits. So the composer thought we better, you know, touch this up a little bit.
Well, the man who retouched Kate Beckinsale is sitting across from me, Whit Stillman. He's been away far too long. It's good to have him back. His new film is Damsels in Distress. It's a treatment. We can also hear at KCRW.com. But I think there's even a karmic aspect to Damsels in Distress, too. Talk about that a little bit.
When you say karmic, what are you
getting at? He's setting forces into nature that have to be either answered or balanced.
Yeah, that's a little over my head. I don't know what to say.
Well, you know, but there is good karma and bad karma, and for every action, there has to be a reaction.
And one of the things that's been a little bit troublesome in the reaction to the film is that people are so conditioned that if there is a group of 3 very pretty, very well-dressed, very opinionated girls, they are going to be the mean or bad ones. And if there is a quiet-seeming, unassumingly dressed, shy girl who comes in, she's going to be the good one. And then at the end of the film, the overdressed girls are going to get their comeuppance. And this film ends up being sort of the reversal of that, that the sort of disillusioning thing we have to adjust to in this film is that this nice-seeming girl isn't actually that great. And so the queen bee, played by Greta Gerwig, is constantly trying to rely and praise and incorporate this girl into their group. And she never quite becomes a full-scale friend. In fact, in certain ways, she's the nemesis. Not entirely the conscious nemesis, but she's the blocking character, keeping Greta Gerwig away from her romantic destiny.
But I meant by karma for Violet's character. She starts off one way and becomes something else by the end of the movie.
I'm not sure if that's entirely the case. She goes through kind of a journey in the course of the movie, but I think she ends up where she wants to be.
But I'm not sure it's where she started, because she has to divorce herself a bit from the group. And she's so ensconced in that group, and she has to step away from it a little bit. We sort of see that they're all kind of rigid, and she turns out to be the least rigid of all of them.
I'd see it as more they're flying in formation at the beginning of the film, and then she goes into a tailspin, and she manages to pull out of the tailspin, and she flies sort of with more joy and determination after recovering from the tailspin. There's certain things that you see in a lot of films that I wanted to stay away from, and I think that although there's very heavy weather she goes through and it seems dicey at times, I don't think where she ends up at the end of the movie is dissimilar from her aspirations at the beginning of the movie. I mean, I think it's sort of a fantasy culmination of what she originally aspired to. And all our films have been kind of utopian visions. And the first three films, it was a utopianism that we tried to keep within the bounds of naturalism and realism to a certain degree. In this film, we go beyond those bounds. And so I'm not sure if it's heightened reality or lowered reality, but we're kind of beyond reality.
It's definitely that, but I guess the reason I'm saying that is that these women all have fairly sort of rigid roles in the group. And after she's been kind of pushed off of her precipice, she has to figure out who she is the way the others never do.
But she ends up, I think, in the same position, in the same flight pattern with the other two as she was in the beginning. I mean, she's still there with Rose and Heather.
Talk to me about casting the other actresses in the film.
Well, that's one thing I was talking about with this nemesis character who everyone thinks is going to be the heroine. And part of it is the casting of a wonderful actress who's very natural and very easy to work with, because she just sort of exists on screen and in a lovely way. Her name is Annalee Tipton. She's been seen. She got a gig on America's Top Model and was beloved in that because she's very charming. And then she was in Crazy Stupid Love as the sexy babysitter with a crush on the Steve Carell character. She makes Lily so likable, it sort of subverts my more obvious intentions of making Lily just very pretty but not really that great. And so that's part of the dynamic of the film, the Greta Gerwig, Annalee Tipton rivalry, competition, battle over men and over the right aspect, the right vision of life. And then it's filled out by a group of actresses and actors doing, I think, pretty funny comic material. One is Carrie McLemore, a Southern belle who plays Heather, who's very pretty and not very bright. And then there is Megalyn playing Rose. And this is a character, she's black and speaks with a very snobby British accent. The original idea I had was to have her one of the sort of colonial, well-educated, very opinionated West Indians, because in my life, I've met many very impressive women from the Caribbean. I worked with them in publishing at Doubleday, and it's been one of my interests in doing the Jamaican film, that this sort of personality exists a lot in the Caribbean. Very dominant, opinionated, funny women. They're sort of the Kate Beckinsale characters from Last Days of Disco, but with cooler accents. And that was the idea for Rose, but Megalyn had just been with a London-based Nigerian friend who had a very posh accent. And she said, well, I have this friend and I could try her accent. And so she did that, and it was quite funny. We wanted to have some scenes sort of explaining the accent at the end of the film. And it was a bit of a high dive, because I only wrote that 4 a.m. Of the morning, the last day we shot. And the weather had turned very cold, and we had the girls in spring dresses, and it seemed like the whole thing was going to be a fiasco. But in the magic or semi-magic of the editing room, it got a lot better. And then with Mark Suazo's score over it, the song you mentioned, it all came together.
We're talking diving metaphors and flying metaphors with Whit Stillman. He's here to talk about his latest film as writer-director. It's Damsels in Distress. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. I'm glad you brought that up, though, about the West Indian women, because it's interesting and great to see people of color really integrated, if you pardon the turn of phrase, in this movie and playing a pretty crucial parts in ways that I find incredibly satisfying.
It was really a happy experience. I had a lot of frustration when I was casting Metropolitan in Barcelona because we had open calls and some of the most engaging, talented performers were black actors and actresses. And they had a great spirit and were multi-talented. A lot of them, I think, were working in musicals. And I really wanted to use them. But in Metropolitan and Barcelona, there's no scope for that. And when I fell in love with early 60s Jamaican music, I sort of was thinking, finally, I'll have the chance to do that. And one of the problems in setting up my Jamaican film is that there's almost no foreign sales for films with black faces in Europe. It's really shocking.
Is that still true?
Yeah, it is true. And there's always the rap against the United States for racism or history of racism. But actually, although consciously there's progressive attitude towards race in Europe, in actuality, it's very hard to get acceptance for films with black casts in foreign markets.
Wow. And what's happening with it now?
I mean, I think the fact that it is Caribbean music-based, I mean, we can try to say that other films, such as the wonderful Wim Wenders' Cuban documentary, Buenavista Social Club, puts us in a different category. But I remember that Spike Lee, some of his great films, got almost no release in Europe. I think School Days, which was a film I really enjoyed, I think it practically wasn't seen in Europe.
What do you think you want to do next? I mean, is it the Jamaican film? Are you ready to get right back to work again now?
I want to do the Jamaican film, but it won't be the next thing. I have another thing I've never talked about, but I was writing that I think would be a very manageable production, so I could continue at this budget and production level of not having it terribly risky commercially and have it really fun and a lot of comedy.
How soon do you think it'll be before you get back to work?
I mean, I don't want to jinx it because I've been so bad about predicting this in the past after 12 years striking out. But I think it could, you know, come out in 2 years.
Well, it'd be nice to see you back in 2 years.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks a lot.
My guest is Whit Stillman. His new film as writer-director is Damsels in Distress. And, of course, it features an international dance craze. A phrase I've wanted to say on this show ever since we started. Our recording engineer and our mixer is J.C. Swanick. This show is edited by my associate producer, Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm not in distress. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.